I just like to smile. Smiling's my favorite.
Make work your favorite.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Hello and welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show. Thank you for listening. The number is 888-914-9149. We have lines open, 888-914-9149. I promised I'd share with you some interesting information about the real St. Nicholas. St. Nicholas the Wonder Worker, as he was referred to and has been for many years. You know, we think of Santa Claus as just sort of this secular figure. He's a secular personage. He's associated with Christmas and Christmas trees and gift giving and all that. But there was an actual man who, or from whom, the story as we get it today of Santa Claus comes. So I'll just share this with you. And this is, by the way, courtesy of Catholic World Report. Their website is catholicworldreport.com. The title is The Seldom Told Stories of St. Nicholas the Wonder Worker. So we all know about the jolly St. Nick that we think about today. In 1809, Washington Irving wrote Knickerbocker's History of New York, a work of imaginative fiction that included several tales about a jolly elfin Dutchman scampering down chimneys to bring gifts to children. The American image of Santa Claus was solidified during this time period. A Visit from St. Nicholas, a poem by Clement Clark Moore, published in 1823, from St. Nicholas, a poem by Clement Clark Moore that was published in 1823, was known as 'Twas the Night Before Christmas, introduced the enduring image of Santa's reindeer and his sleigh, and it fixed the date of his visit to Christmas Eve. These are fun stories that make up an important part of our literary tradition and culture in America. However, stuffing chimney-hung stockings is an ancient tradition that predates the American elf lore, as well as the Dutch, who fill their children's wooden clogs with gifts the night before St. Nicholas Day, which is December 6th. Chucking gold into people's wet socks is a custom started by a young man named Nicholas who lived in Asia Minor around 300. Now, this is modern-day Turkey. There are hundreds of stories told about St. Nicholas of Myra. It's spelled M-Y-R-A. You might pronounce it Myra also. He was born in Lycia on the southwest coast of modern Turkey. His wealthy, pious parents, Theophanes and Nona, read to him the Holy Scriptures and faithfully taught him his prayers, but apparently they died while he was still young. His uncle, Bishop Nicholas of Patara, ordained young Nicholas and made him his personal assistant. The zealous youth proved himself an inspiring catechist in the Christian community and an obedient servant to his uncle. During these dutiful years, he showed great kind-heartedness and generosity by distributing his inheritance from his parents to the poor. During this time, the three grown daughters of a formerly rich inhabitant were in danger of being sold into slavery because of their father's pennilessness. Now, this, by the way, the word slavery here refers to a particular kind of slavery. And since this is a family show, I won't denominate what kind of slavery it was, but it was that kind of slavery. And so these three young women, probably quite beautiful, were in danger of being sold into that particular kind of slavery. Hearing of this, young Nicholas secretly visited the man's house at night, and he threw gold in at the window to provide a dowry for one of the girls. The eldest daughter was soon married, and Nicholas again made clandestine donations for the other two daughters with equally felicitous results. So in other words, all three girls wound up getting married, which saved them from the almost certain fate of being sold into that particular kind of slavery. Modern children who awake with an orange or gold foil chocolates in their stockings reenact this story because, by all accounts, one of Nicholas's gifts landed in a sock that was hanging by the fire to dry. So if you picture the scene, I'm going to pause in the article here. He's standing outside the window. It's nighttime. And he's, you know, you can imagine that if somebody had like caught him or something, hey, there's these three young women in this room, and what are you doing at night standing by the window? Well, there was nothing nefarious about it. He was trying to help this family and do it discreetly. He didn't want to call attention to himself. He didn't want to call attention to them. So he did the best he could, and it worked. So he's standing at the window. It's nighttime, and he's tossing gold coins into this room One of them, it seems, happened to land in one of the stockings that was hung by the fire to dry. And that seems to be where the tradition of hanging stockings by the fireplace came into existence. The young Nicholas was blessed with a pilgrimage to the Holy Land. During the voyage, a storm came up that terribly frightened the crew. But through the prayers of the saint, the waves of the sea were becalmed and the passengers were saved. According to Palestinian Christians, Mar Nukula, St. Nicholas, lived in a cave as a hermit for 3 years after visiting the holy places. In a vision, Nicholas was told to return to Lycia. Years later, an Orthodox church was built over the hermit's abandoned cave at Beit Jala, and Palestinians still commemorate this saint by giving gifts to children on December the 19th. Not long after his return to Asia Minor, Nicholas was made Archbishop of Myra. Difficult years followed for the archbishop and his flock, who were forced underground by the Roman Emperor Diocletian's brutal, expansive persecution of Christians. During this time, the good archbishop, who had the charism of bilocation, often appeared to imprison members of his flock as a model of gentleness, kindness, and love, until the day he too was discovered in hiding. In jail, Nicholas continued to sustain and exhort his fellow believers to endure torture and death for the love of Christ. After Diocletian's death, Nicholas was released and returned to his sacramental duties as a confessor of the faith, a title given to Christians who were imprisoned and tortured for their faith during this period, but not executed. They were extremely revered and respected by their contemporaries. Archbishop Nicholas attended the first ecumenical council at Nicaea in the year 325, where he allegedly assailed the heretic Arius. In the middle of his hearing, Arius stood up on his seat in order to be better heard. Enraged by Arius's denial that Jesus Christ is true God and true man, Archbishop Nicholas strode quickly over to Arius, pulled him down by the beard, and punched him in the face. Gotta love this guy, huh? The scandalized council fathers sprang upon Nicholas, stripped him of his pallium, and threw him in prison for his brutish behavior. That night, Nicholas was visited by the Holy Family, who loosed his bonds and vested him again in his apostolic garb. The bishops were astonished by this miracle and realized that Nicholas's anger was righteous. He was honorably restored to his chair, where the aged prelate slept through much of the remaining proceedings. During one of these naps, the Holy Confessor bilocated again, this time to save more sailors at sea. When he awoke in Nicaea, he was resentfully charged with sleeping through the entire council, whereupon the Venerable Nicholas is said to have answered, "While you were talking, I was busy rescuing a disaster-driven ship at sea. Some of the pious brethren took the ship to be an analogy of the church. Others dismissed his words as the babblings of an old man, but not long after the council, the rescued sailors returned safe home, and traveling through Myra, recognized Nicholas as their deliverer. Not surprisingly, every Greek and Slavic Christian sailor for the past millennium and a half has sailed under the protection of St. Nicholas. In the midst of a storm, Greek sea captains still keep an ancient custom of promising St. Nicholas an effigy of their ship, called a tamata, if the holy wonder worker will save them from calamity." Archbishop Nicholas peacefully fell asleep in the Lord on December the 6th, 343. He was immediately recognized as a saint and the patron of travelers. He is called upon by Christians around the world for deliverance from flood, poverty, or any misfortune. He has especially promised to help those who remember his parents, Theophanes and Nona. St. Nicholas's incorrupt relics were venerated for centuries in the local cathedral church of Myra. Like those of many other saints, his bones exude sweet-smelling myrrh. This holy myrrh has been used by Christian faithful to heal all manner of illnesses. During the Middle Ages, the Turks conquered Byzantine's Asia Minor and hitherto pose a constant threat to Christianity in that region. Because St. Nicholas is the patron of the patron saint of sailors, his stories have spread to every Christian nation. In the year 1087, solicitous for the safety of St. Nicholas's venerable remains, Italian sailors who were devoted to this saint plotted to steal the body and bring it back to their home village. St. Nicholas's relics were thus taken from Myra and translated to the city of Bari, where the saint's body continues to exude holy myrrh, in Italian Sacra Manna, 17 centuries after his death. 1,000 years later, Italians are still devotees of St. Nicholas. It is difficult not to envy them sometimes. They've not only made St. Nicholas their tooth fairy, but once a year they commemorate the pirating of jolly old St. Nicholas's bones, sailing around the harbor at Bari with giant statues of the saint in their boats, followed by a solemn harvesting of his tomb oils. Bari's annual festival of the translation of the relics is a three-day carnival with fireworks, processions, reenactments, fire eaters, the Holy Mass, and that's held every May 7th through 9th. Let's not forget, the article says, our own traditions about St. Nicholas. Here in America, everybody knows that our Santa is funny and fat. He's a white-bearded egalitarian who gives kids whatever they want and knitted sweaters from Grandma that they don't want, whether they were naughty or not, because he's a nice, fair Santa. Our Santa will once again fill the whole world with holiday cheer and magic this 24th of December. Toys for everybody. Irony aside, the biggest problem with a Turkish Santa Claus seems to be that it spoils the best-kept sacrosanct secret in America. If children stop believing in the elf and Santa who flies down from the North Pole with his reindeer, won't they stop getting presents? And if I tell my children the St. Nicholas stories, would that spoil Christmas for someone else's precious child when he hears my son tell the story of St. Nicholas? As in Aesop's fables, the father, the son, and the donkey, you can't please everybody. Telling the truth is not being a spoilsport. It's evangelism. So he goes on from there to talk about how we have a good opportunity to share the truth of the story of St. Nicholas, the real St. Nicholas. And then lastly, he says that it is the Feast of St. Nicholas. Celebrate with the church. St. Nicholas is coming to town. And if you'd like to read that article in its entirety, you'll be able to find it by going to the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick. It's embedded there in our Twitter feed. 888-914-9149. Did you ever know those things about St. Nicholas, Cyrus? Like he punched out Arius and pulled him down by his beard? That must have hurt.
No, there's a few things in that story that I was unaware of. Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah. I'm surprised that it's not more circulated.
Jolly old St. Nick punching people out at the Council of Nicaea.
I do like that. I like it.
I can kind of relate to the fact that they said, hey, you slept through the whole thing. You know, you sit down on a hard surface and you start to fall asleep. The older I get, I guess, the more I can relate to that. 888-914-9149. Let's go over to Wisconsin Rapids now and talk to Pat. Good morning, Pat. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you. I wonder if anyone is aware, well, some people are certainly aware, but folks are getting so busy with the new COVID strain going on. In the defense bill, I had heard that there is a special amendment in there, a special little thing,
provision,
glitch they put in there that women can be drafted, women and girls can be drafted. Did you hear about that?
Yep. Not only have I heard about that, I've been talking about that for years, most recently probably about 2 weeks ago. But yes, I'm very familiar with this. And I'm unhappy about it.
They just put it in the bill, didn't they?
Well, the history of this is somewhat convoluted. So this has been working its way through Congress for some time, and it's a proposal that has been made before. So I think I first heard of it maybe 3 or 4 years ago. And talked about it on the program a few times. It came back to the fore in the last few weeks, where the press picked up on the fact that it's now in this current budget proposal, and it looks like it's going to pass because the votes are there. And I presume that when it goes to the debate, and once it is debated, it will pass. So, yes, I have talked about this, and if you're interested in previous shows where I've talked about it at greater length, just go to relevantradio.com/Patrick and type in women in the draft, and you'll find the shows where I've talked about it. But for the moment, yes, it looks as though it's going to pass when the time comes.
I hope that people call their congressmen and legislators and tell them to absolutely vote that down and make it well known that it is in there, because people are just so busy with all the vaccinations that they have to have and how they're going to bypass that I think it's not getting a lot of attention. And I know Miss Pelosi wanted that in there. She wants the women to be drafted, women and girls. And of course, she doesn't have to worry because her lovely family is all grown, all her five children.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All of my children are grown too, but I do have a daughter my youngest daughter, who is within that age range, so she would be vulnerable to this if it were to pass, and it looks like it will. Well, one thing, this may make you feel better, Pat. We have a national audience of, what's our footprint? It's something like 230 million potential listeners, 200 stations all around the country, and I've been talking about this nationally for some time now. So we have been trying to get the word out about this. And for what it's worth, I oppose this on these grounds. Men and women are different. Men are capable of fighting in wars and battles. And not that women are not capable of that. What I mean, though, is that in the armed services, I fully support a woman's decision to be in the armed services if that's what she wants to do. I have no problem with that. I'm not against it. If this is something that women choose to do, they should be free to do that. But I object to the drafting of women where they are conscripted. That's something I don't agree to. Now, some people will say, well, what about in Israel? Well, that's a different situation insofar as it's a very tiny country, only maybe fewer than 10 million people, as I understand it, maybe 8 to 9 million people, surrounded by hostile countries. And they have to basically only to rely upon themselves for their self-defense. So they have a compulsory conscription in the Israeli Defense Force for men and women, boys and girls, when they reach 18, and they're obligated to serve 2 years. But even in the case of the women, they are not required to fight on the front fighting combat lines. And that is one of the things that is well under discussion with regard to drafting women, that it would not merely be for support roles or other roles that would involve combat, but would theoretically, at least, women could be drafted into combat. And as a father, and a grandfather now of girls who would be old enough to go, I do object to that. Well, Pat, thank you. I appreciate that. It's not a very pleasant topic, but I hope you find that of interest. 888-914-9149. We'll take a quick timeout. We'll come back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show. Whether you're listening on a Relevant Radio station or the Relevant Radio app, wherever you are, thank you for listening. I'll be right back with more right after this. Christmas Eve is coming soon. Now you dear old man, whisper what you'll bring to me. Tell me if you can. When the clock is striking 12. Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
This is swinging, man. Swinging. Of course, it's not the real meaning of Christmas, but if you want to get all secular on us, Cyrus, it is a good song.
You gave me the song.
I probably did. You did. Hey, do me a favor. Get that. What's the one from Chicago that I really like? It's "Oh Come All You Faithful." If you could get the Chicago "Oh Come All You Faithful" ready, that would be great.
All right, just might be your Christmas present this year.
Well, I want it on the show today, so it's going to be an early Christmas present. But it's in there. It's in your bag of tricks. Let's go to Joe in Gilbert, Arizona. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning, Patrick. If you can give me some advice on how to handle some family members that fall away from the church, especially the younger ones, with all this new stuff they can read up on stuff. They clearly want to be Catholic because of the history of the Catholic Church, like the Pope. By the Catholics sending the Spaniards over to, basically invade and destroy the natives over here in Latin America and Southern California and everywhere else, and how they funded Christopher Columbus. Is there truth in that, or how do I defend that?
Not real. Well, yes and no. Let's put it this way. So the Pope did not send Christopher Columbus anywhere. It was King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella of Spain, whose kingdoms had been united and they were finally able to drive the Moors out of the Iberian Peninsula. And it was under their reign that Columbus was funded by the crown. He had sought funding elsewhere, but he was certainly not sent by the Pope. He was not funded by the Pope or sent by the Pope. This was a Spanish expedition. And they didn't know what they were going to find. So it wasn't as though the Pope said, hey, Christopher Columbus, I want you to go over there and rape and pillage and bring back. They didn't know what was over there. They had a few scattered comments from people who had gone earlier or had, you know, had grazed what we think of today as the New World. So if they're telling you that it was the Pope that sent Christopher Columbus, that's simply not true. It's just a matter of recorded history. Now, when Columbus arrived in the New World, did he do, and also the men, maybe more specifically under his care, did they do some bad things with the Indians? Absolutely, they did. And in Christopher Columbus's own diary, his own relaciones, or his relating of the things that he did, he himself says some of the things that were done. So by our modern standards today, we would look with horror at some of the things that were done then. But, you know, not to excuse them or to explain them away, but simply to give context, we have to remember that during this time of colonization, this was something that was done not just by Catholics, but by the Dutch Protestants, the Protestants in England. It was sort of done in general, regardless of your religion. And it wasn't something that was uniquely Catholic. That's something else to keep in mind. But there were good things that were done as well. St. Junipero Serra gives us a good example of that on the other side of the continent, where he spent his life traveling up and down what is now California, establishing the missions as a way to help the indigenous peoples by providing them with a place in the missions, a place of refuge, a place where they could learn trades, a place where they could be safe from marauding tribes who would prey upon them. Give them an opportunity to learn the faith, to be baptized, and to develop in ways that were unavailable to them in their current circumstances. So there was a great deal of good that was done, but we can't deny the fact that there was also a great deal of evil that was perpetrated in the name of greed. So as far as the missionaries are concerned, this is another part of it to keep in mind, is that the Catholic and Protestant missionaries took two different approaches to the indigenous peoples. The Catholic missionaries, so I'm thinking, for example, about the Franciscans and the Dominicans in Mexico, but also the Jesuits in the northeast of the United States, so in what would be New England, upstate New York, lower Canada. The Catholic missionaries would go and live with the people. They would live in their communities. They would learn their languages. This is why we have any number of martyrs, because it was not an easy thing to do. And often they were misunderstood, or they were suspected of, you know, trying to bring in magic or witchcraft or something to these people. So many of them died as martyrs, but they persisted, and they learned their languages. They translated the Bible into their languages. In some cases, they helped them develop a written language, because these indigenous peoples, for the most part, tended not to have written languages. And so they did this because they loved the people. They didn't seek to turn them into Europeans in most cases. In some cases, those who wanted to dress like the Spaniards, they were able to do so. But let's take the Jesuit missionaries in the Northeast. What you see is they enculturated into the cultures of the native peoples. By contrast, the Protestant missionaries tended to do exactly the opposite. Their desire was to see the indigenous peoples learn English or German or whatever the language was from the country that they came from. They wanted the indigenous peoples to dress in European dress and to adopt European customs. And so there's a very interesting distinction here between how the Catholics, by and large, went about their evangelization efforts and how the Protestant missionaries did. So coming down to this present day, it seems that the Catholic model is largely forgotten, and that many people don't realize that not only were there more than just Catholics here, but the Catholics adopted an approach to the indigenous peoples that most people, it seems to me, with their so-called enlightened theories of race and such, that they would be more amenable to the Catholic model of doing this. But I have a feeling that most people today, when they think of Christian missionaries as such, they think of them in that Protestant sense of trying to conform the indigenous peoples into the European colonial way of doing things, et cetera, et cetera. So those are some things that you could say. Now, there are any number of documented books or well-documented books that can help you. I like Dr. Warren Carroll's multi-volume history of Christianity. I think it runs to 7 volumes. And in his volume that deals with the exploration of what is now North and South America, he has quite a bit of information there. And other publishers, that's published by Christendom Press, but other publishers, Ignatius Press, Sophia Institute Press, also have books about the exploration and the evangelization of the Americas. So if you're interested in reading further, I would check those out. Thanks, Joe. Appreciate it. Let's go now to Joan in Los Angeles. Good morning, Joan.
Good morning. I disagree with you just a tiny bit when you said that you agree women should be able to go in the military if they choose to do so. I disagree in the sense that women should not be in anything that there's any combat issues. I think they put men in danger in that situation. I think most men, I think God has innately given men to protect women. And I think when put in that situation, I think that even then they might make bad decisions just to protect the woman, or because that's happened in an article I read about police officers. I think women are okay, like in a non-combative issue, because our enemies are not don't care about political correctness. And I could just imagine the atrocities that could happen if a female is, caught in the field. But I think women have done this to themselves because they're wanting to play on men's football teams and, other sports and be in the locker rooms. And, you know, all those things kind of add up to this, well, now why can't you be drafted? You want to be in this, and you want to be in football, and you want to be in men's roles, and so here you go. So I think it's a really bad idea on a lot of fronts. And as a mother of sons, my sons, I think, would put themselves in danger to protect a woman. And situations like that can happen in combat. A man with a man understands that, hey, this is the way it is, but a man with a woman there, I just think, my opinion only, that it wouldn't be a good idea.
Well, you and I are on the same page. I've talked about this fairly frequently, but I've talked about it any number of times and have voiced more or less the same point that you're making. What I referred to earlier today was that women in combat, if that's what they choose to do, and if they're acceptable to the military in terms of their physical fitness, etc., I'm thinking about helicopter pilots, you know, who evacuate in the midst of bullets and bombs flying around. That's combat, and there are women pilots who operate in that situation and can do so quite well. I would share the same view you do with regard. I wouldn't want to see a woman in a Marine Corps battalion taking a beach or trying to, you know, flush out the enemy in a firefight or something like that because of the reasons that you mentioned. I feel the same way. But given the current circumstances in the military and the fact that women are permitted, at least as I understand it, in most roles, there may be some combat roles that women are not permitted to serve in. I just don't know about that. But what I object to is the women being drafted, where they're forced into the military against their will. So I don't think you and I disagree really on much at all. It's just that with this new draft bill, well, it's a provision within this greater spending package. It looks as though it's going to get to the point where young women will be eligible for the draft. Of course, we don't have a draft right now, but if the draft should ever be reactivated, and this passes, then these young women would be vulnerable to the draft. And I don't like that. I disagree with it entirely. And I do so largely along the lines of what you just said. So I hope that clarifies my position a little bit more. We may still disagree, Joan, but hopefully that clarification helps a little bit.
But Patrick, what do you think about women wanting to play, like even the younger ages, play on the boys' football teams and things like that? That just it starts blurring that line between, I think,
yeah, I don't like it.
Skills and women's skills.
Yeah, no, I've always been opposed to that. You know, as the father of 5 daughters and 6 sons, I never actually remember being in a situation where any of my daughters wanted to play on a boys' sports team. They always played on the girls' teams. But no, I think the likelihood for injury, of course, goes way up because boys are so much bigger and so much more body mass. And I don't want to see my daughter hurt, nor do I want to see a situation where there's an unfair competitive advantage. And we talk about that on the program from time to time about the transgender men who, who pretend to be women so they can win races or matches and things. And I disagree with that as well.
I do, too. Well, thank you for taking my call. I appreciate your answer.
You're welcome, Joan. Hey, theoretical question. I don't know if you have any daughters, but if you do or if you did have daughters who became eligible for the draft, if the draft were reactivated, what would you advise them to do?
Well, first off, I would say pray about it. And then the second thing, I agree with you. If they had the skills to be a pilot and work in the medical part of it, MASH unit, something like that, as they didn't want to do combat, I just wouldn't want to see that.
Infantry.
At all.
Yeah, right. Ground pounding. I don't want to see my daughter do that either.
Right.
I have a daughter.
But I think they're very capable for, you know.
No, it's okay. There must be a little bit of a delay here. But no, I agree with you. If they're qualified and if it's suitable, then yeah. I mean, if that's what they want to do, I completely support that if a woman desires to do that. But what I object to would be the government saying, hey, you know, take this gun and go fight those Iranians, you know, on the burning sands of Iran.
I don't think the draft is good for even men. I mean, if you have people there who really don't want to be there, I wonder how that affects infantry, too.
You know, I'm not an expert on these matters. I've never been in the military, and I was too young for the draft. The draft ended 5 years before I turned 18, the last draft that we had, so I never had to go through it. But having spoken to men who served in Vietnam, for example, I've heard, just anecdotally, for what it's worth, I've heard any number of them say, yeah, I didn't want to go, but when my number was called in the lottery, I went. You know, and I saw guys die, people I knew from back home who went and they died, but I went and, you know, I didn't want to go, but I knew this was what my country was asking of me to do. So I think there's a noble and selfless aspect to this, even if you're drafted, you know, to go and to not draft dodge, not go to Canada, for example. Or
no, I agree with that. But I can also go down to this other tunnel that... you know, I'm a mother of sons, so of course, you know, I'm a little bit more protective. But I have a problem we're allowing people, you know, to come through our borders and everything, and they don't have to be drafted. They don't have to serve. And then so I'm thinking, gosh, our kids have to go over there and serve for these people to be here protected, you know, in a safe country. And they're sending my sons out there. And I have a little bit, I hate to say that because it sounds so awful because I'm very military, but I don't think as a mother, it kind of bothers me a little bit.
As it would probably also bother you to know that the current administration is figuring out how to give a $450,000 or thereabouts payment to illegal aliens who were separated from their families when they got here as a way to recompense them. I don't think your sons are likely to get $450,000 payouts from the government for anything.
No.
But there are clear injustices, clear imbalances, and misplaced priorities. No question about it. And that the one that you just identified is one of them. That's true.
Well, thank you for taking so much time with me. I really appreciate it. Have a good day.
Happy to. Thank you, Joan. Appreciate the call. 888-914-9149. We'll take a break and come back. It feels like we take a break every 2 minutes, but we don't. I mean, the show just goes by that quickly. It's just how it is. Give me a call. We have time. 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app. Relevant Radio runs on horsepower. Your horsepower. Donate any vehicle and keep our stations running. Join in with hundreds of other listeners who have donated their used vehicles at relevantradio.com/car.
Get connected to the conversation. Call now. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
Oh, come. Faith.
This is the song, Cyrus.
Merry Christmas. There's people like, it's not Christmas yet. It's not Christmas.
I know. It's a season of Advent. It's a season of Advent, but we're casting a broad net here at Relevant Radio. So we don't expect everybody to understand the distinction between Advent and Christmas, but we're heading toward Christmas. This, by the way, is from the Chicago Christmas album. That's Jason Scheff, the former bass player for Chicago, singing this one. Beautiful. Thanks, Cyrus. Thanks for getting that for me. Let's go back to the phones. We'll go to Rod in Eureka, California. Good morning, Rod.
Good morning. A few times I've heard on your show that you said heaven was our final destination, but the Bible seems to teach that our final destination is here on earth, you know, where the meek will inherit the earth. In Revelation 5, it says we'll become kings and priests and rule over the earth. In Revelation 21, where New Jerusalem will come out of heaven and reside here on earth, and God will dwell amongst his people. So I'm just wondering, is that a contradiction? Am I wrong?
I would say it's not a contradiction. It may be just a slight misunderstanding here. So St. Peter says that the elements, the earth and everything in the created universe will be dissolved by fire. So at the end of the world, something cataclysmic is going to happen, and all of the material elements will somehow be, as he says, dissolved with fire. But what you're seeing here is not two different things, but the same thing, and that is that the new heavens and the new earth merge into one single reality. So whereas right now you and I as creatures who are comprised of spirit and matter, we experience the material world. We can't see the supernatural realm. We can't see angels. We can't see God. We can't see demons. They're all there, but it's beyond our natural abilities to detect through our senses. But what Revelation is referring to there is this, in essence, a merger between the supernatural realm and the natural realm, so that just as at the end of the world, your physical body with all of its imperfections and my physical body with all of its imperfections will be perfected and glorified, it will be imbued with the supernatural. So this is how you and I will be able to experience heaven forever in our glorified bodies. We'll experience it physically, but we will be in that supernatural realm. The two will be merged together. So what the Bible's referring to there is that, yes, our ultimate destination, of course, is the beatific vision, seeing God face to face for all eternity. And as the Bible explains it in Revelation, that reality now for us as human beings will be merged into one single reality where the physical realm, whatever that will wind up being, and the supernatural realm will be one. And it will be in that reality that we will experience God spiritually and physically forever. So it's both and, not either or, if that makes sense.
So do you think we're going to get our glorified body? It's not, you don't think it's going to be flesh and blood then?
Yes. Well, we will have glorified bodies. So your body that you have now is the same body you will have then, but it will be super enhanced. It will be perfected. And it's not like you're going to get a different model, you know, a different version of your body.
Right,
it will be this body. And that's amazing to think about, but it will be so far beyond what we can do in our bodies now. It will be so super enhanced. It's hard to imagine what that would be like. But yeah, it'll be a physical as well as spiritual enjoyment of God and the things of God for all eternity.
So flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of God. So if flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of God, where does our fleshly bodies? I mean, it's got to reside here on earth, you'd think. Why make a new heaven and a new earth if we're not here to enjoy the new earth? You know, I'm not.
We will
really
be
standing still.
Okay. So we will be there. We will be in the new heaven and the new earth because they will be merged. So it'll be the same single reality, as opposed to what you think of and what I think of as the earth, you know, planet Earth, this rock in space that we're on. It won't be like that. It will be renewed, but it will no longer be isolated in the sense of how you and I experience it in a purely physical manner. When the new heavens and the new earth merge, it'll be one single reality. But I'd like to address the point you made about flesh and blood. That is a Hebraism. That's a figure of speech that means the, you know, the worldly, fleshly, human, limited, partial way of things. So when
sinful.
Jesus said to Simon, it could include that too. So when Jesus said to Simon Peter in Matthew 16:18, he says, mere flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. What he's saying there is this is not just, you know, from some guy who told you this, some run-of-the-mill human being. So it's a figure of speech that's not intended to mean it by saying flesh and blood, it doesn't preclude or exclude the fact that we will have physical bodies in the coming kingdom, in the coming merger of the new heavens and the new earth. It's just a figure of speech, and it was a way to denote earthly things as opposed to heavenly things.
Okay. Well, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
Appreciate
happy
it.
To, and call me anytime. I appreciate the phone call. 888-914-9149 is the number to call. Let's go now to Juan in Los Angeles. Good morning, Juan.
Good morning, Patrick. So my question is in reference to, I've always traditionally, or more commonly, gone to church and attended ceremony and mass in Spanish. And in Spanish, we have this, a prayer, I guess. It's el signo de la cruz, de persinas. Por la señal de la Santa Cruz de nuestros enemigos, líbranos, Señor Dios nuestro, en nombre del Padre, del Hijo, del Espíritu Santo. And when we go to mass in English, All I've always heard traditionally has been, in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Is that two different things? Is that a Hispanic tradition? Or as a child, I was taught that. Or is that just, there's not that necessarily that prayer or that verse for English? That's my, confusion or question.
Yeah, you're correct. It is a custom. It is definitely Hispanic, and it's not something that you would find Americans doing in English. That's why you don't see it. It's also similar to how, you know, how when you make the sign of the cross, you make multiple signs of the cross. So you sign your forehead,
right.
You sign your, okay. So
your
Americans
forehead, your
don't
mouth,
do
your
that.
Chest, and your whole self.
Right. Yeah. So Americans and Europeans and in other parts of the world, Japan, other places where I visited, they don't do that. So it's just a custom. It's something that's, visible and common in Latin America, but you wouldn't find it in most of the rest of the world. It's just a custom. Nothing wrong or right one way or the other.
It's a cultural thing. It's traditional culturally. That's what we've been taught by our predecessors and ancestors. And that's
That's a good way to look at it. Yeah, it's a beautiful custom, and different customs appear in different places, and they're all beautiful, each in their own way. That's how I would chalk it up.
Yeah, it's just when I try to explain it to my kids who are going through catechism now and in English, they're like, hey, how come it's so much longer in Spanish? And, you know, I'm trying to explain it so now I can have a better explanation for them.
Yeah. Yeah, you could say in Spanish we get even more. You know, we have even more to enjoy than they do
already.
In,
well, thank you,
rest
Patrick.
Of the world.
Appreciate it. God bless you.
You got it, Juan. Thank you. Appreciate that. 888-914-9149. Yeah, it's interesting to go, like, if you are not Hispanic, or even if you are, but you're not used to going to a Spanish mass, go there sometime and avail yourself of the cultural expression of the faith at a Spanish-speaking mass, and you'll find a lot of interesting differences, and they're good. You know, I think it's very enriching, if you ask me. Let's go now to, let's go to Victoria in Rockland County, West Virginia, excuse me, New York. Welcome, Victoria.
Hey, thank you, Patrick. Just a statement. You were questioning, well, I'm pretty sure you know the answer to it, but $450,000 to each illegal immigrant that's coming in that the Biden administration is giving. If you think about it, I think they're buying the 2024 election because all these immigrants are going to be voting for the Democrats. That was my thought, and a lot of other people are thinking the same way. So just if you want to throw it out, you know, I'm sure everyone is hearing it now. It's something to think about. So if we really want to get a Republican in that's going to change this administration, we have a lot of work to do. So anyway, God bless, and just Thank God this program is on. I have many people listening to it, and you changed many lives, including my own. God bless you, darling.
Well,
bye-bye now.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And let's pray for our country. What better thing that we can do than be patriotic through our prayers? Let's see. Let's go now to Melissa in Denver, Colorado. Is there snow on the mountains right now, Melissa, in Denver?
Well, they're always up in the high elevations, but we're really not seeing anything in the lower elevations. So we're okay but even though it's 20 degrees. So anyway, I do so many of the things you've talked about I love, but one thing I have one question from the caller a couple times ago. When the people of Latin heritage, like, do all the crosses, I was told once that they hold their fingers in such a way that the thumb and the first finger make a cross when they do their crossing. Is that right?
Put your thumb across the middle section of your forefinger. You know, there's like three sections to it, fingertip, middle, and then toward your hand. If you were to put your cross against the middle of that, that would be what you're referring to. And you'll notice typically at the very end, as an Hispanic person makes the sign of the cross, multiple crosses, he will then kiss his thumb. And the reason for that is that it's in the shape of a cross. So therefore, the conclusion of making the sign of the cross is the kissing of the cross, as the thumb and forefinger make the shape of a cross.
Fabulous to confirm that, because I think that's so beautiful. And I had heard it, and I always wondered. So the reason I called, though, is I come from a very military family, retired lieutenant colonels in Army, and I presently have a nephew and a son who are, my son is not quite called up yet. He's graduated. He's a second lieutenant, Air Force. My nephew, though, is in pilot training, and he was forced to get the vaccine, which he gave into. My son, this is sort of off topic, I guess, now that I think about it. My son is facing this, that he will not be able to train to be a pilot unless he vaccinates. So he's discerning the whole thing right now because he is so not interested in getting the vaccine, but his life has been, his dream has been to serve the country as a pilot. My reason for saying that is when we do military things, in laying our lives down for our country, we are asked to take on issues, if you want to say that, that the general public does not have to take on. And that is all these vaccines and shots and pills and then going into combat and the whole shebang. Well, when you are active military woman, you are not allowed to be pregnant. And so that's why myself, I don't like the idea of a woman in the draft, is they are asked to go beyond, above and beyond, in my mind, laying their lives down for their country. They are asked to, in a sense, live a sterile life, and who knows what all the medicines and other things they do. But that's what's so heartbreaking. My niece, who was ROT.
I wish I had more time, Melissa. I apologize for my interruption. I really do. God bless you and your family for all the service to this country. I'm so grateful for that. I'll be right back with more of The Patrick Madrid Show right after this. Wow.